Hello and welcome to Avachine Podcast. In this podcast, we welcome guests who are waging a struggle. My name is Frederike Geerdink. I'm a journalist who writes and speaks about power structures and those who want to tear them down. This podcast is powered by Media News, which you can visit at medianews.net. Let me explain why this podcast is called Avachine, meaning blue water. Avachine is a region in the mountains of Kurdistan, where the river by the same name has its source. The Avachine is clear, blue, and sparkling, and an inspiration in the Kurdish struggle for freedom. In this episode, I'm honored to welcome Freer Verkerke as my guest. Freer lives in Amsterdam, the Netherlands. They're a seasoned trans rights activist, and they're active for the left-wing political party Bijeen in Amsterdam City Council. Welcome as my guest, Freer.
Thank you for having me, Frederike.
My first question to you is, what is the source of your struggle for trans rights? And, you know, where did it begin for you?
I think that my struggle started for trans rights really started from the moment that I discovered that the whole procedure as it used to be to change your body and your gender was very unfair. I started my procedures, my changes towards who I am now, in the beginning of the 1990s. And in those days, you had to undergo all kinds of psychological, psychiatric testing. It took a long time before you could get the medical assistance that you needed. And then it took a court case to change the legal aspects of your gender. And that I came to realize that that was weird, that it was a case of inequality and inequity. So together with a couple of people, I started fighting for change. First, just on a low level to get the options, the possibilities to have our medical procedures in the way that we wanted it and not the way that the medical establishment wanted it. Which meant that we as trans people demanded the possibilities to get the medical assistance that we needed, which means that sometimes you wouldn't really have any medical help, any real medical procedures, sometimes only hormone treatment, sometimes just surgeries, depending on what the individual wanted. And that was unheard of in the 1990s. And only since the beginning of the 2000s, a more global struggle started to get representation of trans people, to get the human rights struggle going. It took some time, as with probably everything, to phrase your repression and your oppression in human rights terms. So that was kind of what kicked it off, the realization, hey, here are human rights violations going on. People don't grant us the rights that we should have as people requesting medical support and legal support to be able to live the way we want. And they just don't grant it because they minoritize us and make us a minority, which in itself is correct, but a minority that thus doesn't get the rights it needs, that thus stays oppressed.
Because can you explain a little bit what it was like in the 1990s? Because then this subject was not as much talked about in the mainstream as it is now, and not even that much now in the mainstream, but still.
Exactly.
Like can you, because I think it has to do with society being very normative in a hetero way and people being seen with the gender they are assigned.
Yes,
at
definitely.
Birth, like you're a man or you're a woman, and that is the identity that's, you're being pushed in, right?
That's the idea. That's the mainstream idea. Surely in the 1990s and before, like where to start? Trans people have been present always, everywhere. It doesn't matter where you are. Gender diversity is a global phenomenon. it just depends on like how it plays out, how people present themselves, identify themselves is regional. Like people saying, I'm a non-binary trans person, that as is very common these days in the Western world, maybe a new phrasing, but people who do not identify with either male or female have been always everywhere. We can find them back in the older religions, we can find them back in recent historical traces in current day.
And everywhere in the world also?
Yes, everywhere in the world. There's actually no place where it is not or has not been. When you look at Latin America, before the Dutch, the Spaniards, and the Portuguese came, there was gender diversity. It was just literally slain down by the Spaniards. They really killed the people who were gender digressing. In the Middle East, that has also been the case with all the occupations. Sometimes people were more positive, sometimes people were less positive, but we have always been there. Sometimes in honored roles, there have been gender diverse people in the courts, in the royal courts, not in the legal courts. As it was also sometimes considered a position of honor. Like trans people were among the shaman, people who are considered to be the mediator between heaven and earth. And sometimes in Western world called sorcerers and magicians. Well, often those people were, for example, that we now call trans people. So we have a huge past in that sense. In the Western world, that has been destroyed by the Nazis in the 1930s when they destroyed the library of the famous sexologist Magnus Hirschfeld. Thanks to this fact, we know far less than we used to. We had a huge setback.
This was a library with a lot of information about this subject, or?
Yes, very much, because Hirschfeld was the first kind of modern day sexologist and had a very big interest in queerness and in trans people. He was like one of the very first people in the Western world to try to medically help trans people. One of the first people in the Western world to do surgery on trans people because they needed that, they requested that. And then only from the 1960s, roughly, people started to come in bigger numbers because one of his students actually became a doctor in the United States. He was Jewish, so he fled for the Second World War. We're talking about Harry Benjamin. Benjamin wrote The Transsexual Phenomenon, and that was kind of the Bible for trans people to use as the canonical story, like, this is how I am, because it gave him recognition. And as Benjamin was a renowned doctor, he got all the recognition and all the authority to state, well, trans people are like this. Well, okay, so if we are like this, according to the book, then we need to present that way, because otherwise we don't get anything. But as we can see with women's emancipation and with gay emancipation and lesbian emancipation, bisexual, etc., the whole LGBTQIA, is a question of emancipation. First, you discover things are not nice. I feel oppressed, or I feel not taken seriously in my wishes. And then you start phrasing it as an oppression, and then you start thinking, hey, but if there's an oppression, then it's a power relation and it's political, and I need to be able to do something against this. So slowly people started emancipating, partially together with the gay movement in the 1970s and going on from then. There was a long tradition of trans people within the gay movement. Part of the feminine gay men nowadays identify more as trans. Otherwise, on the
because
other
one,
hand...
Because one thing, a little, let's go a little bit back, because there you make sort of a jump from it being like a personal thing to making it a political issue, right?
Yes.
You come to see it as a power construct. Like the majority is not like us, so the majority is in power and has the power to deny us the rights that we should have.
Yeah. Exactly. The majority is different. The majority doesn't question themselves. The majority goes with the mainstream construct of being cisgender heterosexual.
And cisgender is? Because cisgender, I think some people will not understand.
Not question their gender. Cis people are people who not... Cisgender people do not question their gender, at least not as fundamental as trans people. It's just
like I'm cisgender because I was born as a woman and I identify as a woman, and I don't question that. I feel comfortable.
You are
I feel comfortable as a woman,
and you're okay with that. That makes you a cisgender person.
Yeah.
And I was not happy with that on several levels. So that makes me a trans person because I transgress.
Yeah.
It's cisgender is just like cis Jordan and trans Jordan in the old days. It's a geographic, it originates as a geographical description, like on this side of the River Jordan and that side, the other side. So you go from cis, you transgress, you transition to another side.
But for you, it is now not that much about being male or female. For it's much more fluid now, right?
I don't understand gender in that sense anymore. Yeah. I refuse the power construct, the power relation of the gender. I kind of grew and decided in towards a different solution. I might call myself agender, as in I don't have anything with the existing genders, or multigender, as I always say, as the wind blows my gender. I have no clue where.
That's beautiful. As the wind blows my gender.
So to speak, with which foot I get out of bed, and what kind of socks I wear that day, that may decide on my gender of the day. Gender is, in that sense, irrelevant to me on a personal level.
And for you, you were talking about the 1990s, so you've been involved also in this activism since then, or you immediately start the activism?
In the 1990s. As I said, by the end of the 1990s, people started really questioning the need of conforming to standard procedures. As a couple of people said, like, hey, but I got a clear body image and I want my body to reflect the image that I have of the body, which was not granted by the doctors, the surgeons and the endocrinologists. So the hormone doctors were disagreeing because they were thinking us still to be pathologized, very important word here, pathologization, being seen as, being declared as either physically or mentally ill. We are still in, as trans people, we are still in a global psychiatric classification, the United States-based DSM, Diagnostic Statistical Manual for Mental Health Issues. However, since 2018, officially
that is still the case.
Yeah.
Trans people are being seen as a psychiatric
handbook. Yeah. However, on the global level, originating from the World Health Organization, there's an international classification of diseases, and that is for everything mental and physical. There we have been deep psychopathologized, which means we are not considered anymore to have a mental health issue, to have a disturbed self-image. We are seen as people having a medical issue. They cannot find where it's grounded, how it works, but anyway, it is there, and all kind of medical associations have confirmed this, like, yes, indeed, this is just an issue of self-image and people are this way and we cannot really do anything to change that, and we shouldn't actually. And as we have been deep psychopathologized, we now have the right, the principal right, to just get the medical assistance that we need, that we request. In not all countries this is possible, but it should be possible. And everywhere where it is possible, it should go in that way, that there is no required, no forcible psychological testing, no forcible psychological treatment or psychiatric treatment before we enter a regime of medical assistance.
Yeah. And what kind of methods have you used in your struggle? Because I always find it interesting to talk about methods that you can use to reach your goal. There are so many things you can do. What have you done?
True. There's indeed a whole sleight of hand in method. We first started out in just talking to the doctors. That in the beginning there was no platform that we could use. There was a kind of there were half yearly meetings between the working group on transsexuality, as it was called in those days, and the gender team in Amsterdam. But as a
gender team in Amsterdam is the team in the academic hospital in Amsterdam where trans people can go for treatment.
Yeah, the Amsterdam Trans Clinic at the Free University Hospital. So there was like a twice yearly meeting between the actually a kind of self-help humanistic organization that supported trans people and the hospital team. But the hospital team was very rigid, saying like, no, this is the way it is, this is the way we can do it. But many people, a couple of people at least went there regularly trying to convince the doctor, like, hey, it's my body, I have these wishes, I want it to be in this way. And if you start saying no, you must do it in this way, that then you actually enforce me to have again a different body, to get again a dysphoric feeling about who I am. Again, I cannot live to the fullest of my feelings
of who you are.
I can.
And
still
then
not be
again,
myself.
Doctors. The problem was that doctors kept defining what your body should look like and what kind of operations you should and should not have.
So we started out with talking to them, but to very little avail. Only very few people could, on the personal level, convince the surgeon, like, sorry, but this is not the way. Can you do it a bit less? Can you do a bit more of this? Well, when they're in the process of working, then of course they can do that. They find it a bit strange, but hey, surgeons are kind of maybe more used to people having specific wishes in general than other doctors. So like when you have some kind of surgery, it may happen that you say, oh, well, as you're operating on my belly, maybe suck out a lot of body fat. And that was not normal in the beginning either. Nowadays, it's almost like, oh, well, you do have quite some body fat there. Shall I help you get rid of a bit of that also while we're busy? So surgeons are a bit easier often in that sense. But
in the beginning, talking to the surgeons and to the teams, the medical teams, didn't really help.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
And then we went on, and as the first meetings with the two teams, the self-help groups and the medical doctors didn't work out. At the same time, already a bit earlier, there was a protest of trans people who went to The Hague, to Parliament, of the petition to the president, to the chairperson of Parliament, saying like, we in a dignified way demand the right to change our legal gender. That was already before. But that led to the fact that there came a law that demanded all these medical procedures. Before there was no law, so that you, before halfway to the 1980s, there was no law at all. So it was depending on the judge what would be possible. Now there was a law that required us to undergo medical procedures in order to change a legal issue, which is very weird and actually a violation of human rights.
Why is that a violation of human rights? Can you explain?
Because it was a requirement.
Yeah.
You cannot require a person to change their body in order to get some legal recognition.
But people would say
about the integrity of the body.
Yeah, but people would say you want to change your body, or
the same way that you cannot force someone to get pregnant or to get an abortion.
Yeah,
that has happened, however.
Yeah, people would think, but you want to change your body. So what is the problem?
But you want to change it in a way. You may want to change it in a way that you want it, but there were very clear demands in the law. Like, it had to be adapted as far as possible to the other sex.
So you were really forced to take certain procedures and operations.
Exactly.
And that basically meant that the state told you have to have this operation on your body.
Yeah.
And that is, of course, very clearly a human rights violation, because no state can tell you what to do to your body.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
There's integrity.
Yeah, we have to make it very clear, because for some people it can be complicated, like, you want to change your body, of course, but no state can ever tell you how to do that.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
It's still my my own authority over my own body, what can happen. Later on last year, the state finally made their excuses for this human rights violating law. The Netherlands is the only country up to now that made public excuses for this.
Yeah, for forcing people to have certain surgeries. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. Sweden did pay the victims of these procedures in their country far more than we received as victims. But on the other hand, they did not really give excuses in the sense of, oh, yes, you're so right, we should never have done this. Is such a violation of human rights.
Yeah. And now, like in the 90s, you were talking to surgeons directly.
Yeah.
And not making your struggle very public. But now the struggle has become much more public. And what brought this change about, do you think?
I think it has to do with more knowledge of human rights. It has to do with broader emancipation struggles. The gender and sexuality emancipation struggles grew from the 1970s onward. Trans people are running behind some 25 years in this, as we can relatively the new kid on the block. Well, nowadays we're followed by intersex people who are waging the same struggle. But
Intersex people who are, can you explain most
intersex
basically
means
intersex
that,
people?
Also has the old name hermaphrodites, but or a modern pathologizing name, differences in sex development. Intersex people are people whose sexed bodies, so whose sex organs, whose gonads, whose sex hormones differ significantly from the mainstream, or from what is being accepted as mainstream. They're too masculine, or not masculine enough in their bodies.
But isn't it also like very much like the state of your body, like you're born with signs of both sexes? Yeah, okay.
That's a myth. It's a myth that people would be born with a mixture, with a visible mixture of sex organs, of genitals. That's a myth. That only is a very tiny percentage. And then again, it's mostly a question of being too male, too female, or not male or female enough in the eyes of the doctor. And not all of these phenomena are directly visible. Some things you can only find out indirectly, and then by taking a chromosome sample, and okay, yes, we see that you don't have XY or Y or XX chromosomes differently. So that is a bunch of phenomena that we call intersex,
okay,
which also is a kind of foreign definition, because these people, and these people are pathologized, which means they're declared sick or being deviant, and in some societies they're really ousted and they're being persecuted for being too different. It's just a different, again, a different form of being, and as all these things influence your way of being, your way of feeling, and your way of being in the world, of course you will be different, but it's always the difference that gets persecuted. That is the whole issue. And intersex people then kind of in their struggle now stand on the shoulders of trans people, can take up the struggle, don't have to do all the things that we have done, as we didn't have to do all the things that many gay people have done before us. We could profit from part of their struggle. It goes on. Time has passed, of course, also. So now there's a bigger LGBTQI, the Q is for queer, I for intersex, also people add the A for asexual people. A gender and sexuality, actually a sex, gender and sexuality struggle, liberation struggle. That is what's going on.
Yeah, that is what it is. That is good to, that is good also to connect different struggles, that it is a liberation struggle.
Yeah, definitely. It's an emancipation and liberation. We try to liberate us from the shackles that have been, that we've been put in by the mainstream cisgender hetero white world, because it's a colonial construct. The way that we live our genders, our sexuality, our colonial constructs are the result of colonial thinking from Western mainland, from the Netherlands had a big role in this. We were a huge colonizer, and we still haven't shed off our colonial yoke.
I think that's very interesting to connect it to coloniality, because From what I heard, like colonial powers like the Netherlands, they when they came somewhere and they occupied lands, in many of these lands there was much more diversity in genders.
Yeah,
and they suppressed it. They said, and how is why did they do that?
They had a belief. They framed it religiously. They had the, but it was a combination of, it was a combination of religious beliefs and just kind of strange thinking. That I don't really know the roots of, but at least they framed it religiously, their ideology, that you could only be in a certain way. They did it already in Latin America. When the colonizers came to Latin America, they really slew the gender diverse people there. There's coming more and more proof also that many indigenous people in the Americas have consciously been contaminated with illnesses that apparently were very lethal to them, like the flu, for example, and other and all kind of other stuff. That was no coincidence. So Western colonizers always have done this, and from the 18th century there was a clear scientific thinking, very much based in specific religious and born-ated thinking, that people needed to be in a certain way. Everything else was a digression, abomination. You still see that in the United States now with the whole conservative white thinking.
And it's connected to patriarchy also, right?
Yeah. It's very patriarchal. Society was very patriarchal in those days. It often still is very patriarchal. I think we don't need to tell the Kurds about patriarchy in that sense. Yeah. Well, in a sense, yes, because in general, Kurdish society is also still very patriarchal. But on the other end, there is the liberation struggle, Rojava, and of course in the cities where feminism and to a lesser extent probably queerness is present and is very manifesting. So yes, it's a liberation struggle against patriarchy, patriarchal thinking, and that means that we've always been kind of in resistance against all kind of imposed ideas of this is how people should be.
Yeah, because that's what the patriarchy wants. Also, the patriarchy wants a very extremely male kind of men, very like a man very much in control and in power, which means you have to have somebody who has to, like, you have to need a subject, which is the woman. So it has to be very binary, like we're the men and there are the women and nothing can be in between. Because if there's something in between, the patriarchy can weaken. And if
a man shows weakness, then only in the house and between closed doors.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned Rojava and that you mentioned Kurds, because that's also how we saw each other at demonstrations sometimes. And then it turned out that you were not only a trans activist, but you're very... you feel very connected to the Kurdish struggle as well, and to, for example, the Palestinian struggle. And so can you tell me about how you see the connections between your struggle as a trans activist and the struggle that the Kurds are waging?
I think that the easiest connecting slogan would be nobody is free until we are all free. And that's really a case. Nobody is free until all are free. My freedom depends on your freedom, depends on the freedom of women, of there's also of Palestinian women and Kurdish women, because it's everywhere a struggle against patriarchy and against capitalism. These are the main concerns, the main issues that are inhibiting us from living our life to the fullest. They're destroying the planet, destroying societies. The current war in Ukraine is also a very patriarchal and imperialist war. Patriarchal, you see that in the way that Putin and his ilk are behaving. Capitalist, because it gives the opportunity to send, again, lots of weapons, which is also, of course, climate destroying. Everything is, in the end, connected.
Yeah. You're also connected to the environmental struggle.
Is connected. Yeah. And if I fight for the Kurdish ideal of having Kurdish autonomy, I also fight for Catalonian autonomy, because in Catalonia, the northeast of the Spanish state, people are waging a similar struggle, not as violent and as violently oppressive as the struggle of the Kurds against the Turkish state, against the Iraqi, Iranian, and Syrian state. But it is still the same struggle for autonomy. It's a struggle of a people that has been forcibly become part of another state or group of states. And the interesting thing that connects Catalonia and the Kurdish struggle explicitly is that it is not about the territory itself. Yes, they live in a territory, but it's not about a territorial state. And that is very important. And that is actually the revolutionary thing in all of these struggles. States are also, again, a construct, a concept. The modern nation state, as we know, is an 18th, 19th century construct and has only led to more problems, has been a catalyst for more capitalist competition. Nowadays, everything big and capitalist is transnational and supranational, but it started out with with nation states to like around the industrialization of the world, of the West world to start with, and then of course the rest of the world as the workplaces for the profit that went to the West.
It's kind of interesting for me what you say now that you I hear you say this, like Kurdistan and also Catalonia are forced to be part of a state, which is a construct. And then I think of you as a trans person, as a trans activist. You are also forced to fit into structures of being either male or female. And you're also fighting for your autonomy to be something else. You don't want to be either man, either woman. You want to have your autonomy to decide about your own identity. So it's you know, there's a comparison there. I didn't think of it before
There's a couple of comparisons. There are definitely parallels. I refuse the boxes that they give me. It's not that I live and think outside boxes. The question is more, there is no box.
There is no box. You are freer, and that is the box. The box is freer.
Yeah, exactly. Of course, it's a hint to the Matrix movies, where Neo, the one, comes to a place and where comes to see the Oracle and sees a kid like bending a teaspoon, and the kid looks up at Neo and says, "There is no spoon. There's never been a spoon. There are no gender boxes. They're all constructs."
Just as nation states are constructs, also these very black and white genders are also constructs.
Very material, of course. I mean, we daily, every moment we experience the physical, the material aspects and consequences of these constructs, but still, they're not natural. And that means they're historical, and that means we can change them. And that's what we see.
Yeah. And I know that you sometimes go to demonstrations, for example, for Palestinian rights.
Yes.
And often Turkish Dutch people show up there too. And you try to talk to them about the Kurdish struggle. Is that true? Tell me about it.
I quit talking to them. That's senseless because...
Really? You quit talking to them?
They are very much in favor of Palestinian autonomy, but they hate Kurdish autonomy. Most of them. Only a couple of them support Kurdish autonomy. But when I start chanting for also Kurdish autonomy, because you cannot be in favor of Palestinian autonomy and against Kurdish autonomy, that would be very weird and inconsequential, they get so fucking angry at me. I only can laugh at them, like look at them in wonder, like, what is happening with you?
So you stop trying to convince them because it's very like impossible.
It's senseless. Like
really,
it's part of the official ideology in Turkey, of course. Already since the Turkish state as we know it started with Atatürk. One of the consequences of the liberation from the Osmanic Empire was actually the taking away of Kurdish autonomy. And as now already like some 10 generations have been educated in that system in all its different ways, you have to be very conscious about how things work to understand how...
And that's interesting
because...
these
things are connected.
Yeah. That's interesting because Turks have been educated in this system since the beginning of the Republic,
like
100
now,
years
roughly.
Ago. Yeah. But the same, much longer, probably, I'm not sure, you know it better, we have been forced to think in male and female. So that is also something that is very deeply in people who are not like trans people or in other way not fitting in the boxes. That is also very deep in our system to think.
Definitely.
To get away from that, you know, box thinking.
Yeah. The fun thing in that I think, however, is that this, however, is also has very physical aspects. It's about bodies and body images, about how you feel in your body. Very physical. And I think that makes the urgency bigger. Actually, every oppression is felt in a physical way. And exactly the physical aspects of oppression make it, make the oppression urgent at a certain moment, which explains why there is so little solidarity the further you go away from a certain place of conflict. It's not felt anymore. But trans being a very physical thing in that sense definitely makes the urgency higher and our struggle more intense than some other struggles.
Yeah. And now you've taken it to the city council as well with the small leftist party Bijeen, which means together.
It means united together.
United together, yeah.
Yeah.
So this is also connecting different struggles.
Exactly. That is, we explicitly say that we are an intersectional party. We recognize the intersectionality of struggles, which means not an oppression Olympics in which people say that they have been oppressed far more and far heavier, have a heavier load of oppression because they're... they're black, they're disabled, they may be Kurdish, all these things like heaping up. No, it's not about heaping up of oppressions, it's about life being more complicated. Intersection is after the traffic intersection. On certain streets, certain people run higher risk of being hit by a vehicle more times than others, and that's the issue.
That's a good explanation.
Yeah,
that's a good explanation of intersection.
It's
like
streets
coming together, and some people are more inclined to get hit than others.
Yeah. It's really where it started from. If you read the article by the Combi River Collective that spelled it out, the whole intersectionality thing, where it all started, is exactly that because of this that they say intersection. And we recognize that there's not one struggle. In my case, I'm a trans person, but I'm non-binary, genderqueer, I refuse those boxes, which makes it complicated. But on the other hand, I'm still a white person and relatively able-bodied. So if you're not white as a trans person living in the Netherlands, if you will be undocumented, there would be not two, but probably four times as many possibilities of getting, of clashing with the...
Oppressed.
With society. Because these things interact and intersect. It has consequences for getting a job. If you are undocumented, then it's already complicated. But if you're undocumented and trans, you have extra issues.
Yeah. So that is why, you know, all these, you say you're also white, which makes it a little bit easier for you. You are not physically handicapped, which makes again a little bit easier for you, but being trans makes it harder.
Yeah.
So all these different identities, all these different related to power structures, because being white puts you in a group in society that is in power.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
And from my side, I try to be a white traitor, of course. I hate whiteness as a political construct, as a political power structure. So I really try to be a white traitor, to betray every whiteness that I can find. I think nobody can be a perfect white traitor. You always are studying, you always are in training. As it's complicated to always be liberatory anyway, probably. I think that also applies to other groups and to other issues. As for example, as we're in a kind of Kurdish environment now, the feminism and the pro-queerness in Kurdish circles is not a given. It's a process. It's everywhere a process, but also in the Kurdish communities. And I know too many Kurdish people who are very skeptical of queerness. So it is a struggle. It's an ongoing process of learning that it's connected and that we're all talking about oppressions.
So yeah, maybe we can
more or less oppressed, but it's all connected by being oppressions.
It's interesting. I find it interesting to say that you are sort of a traitor to whiteness. You try to undermine the power of being white. And that maybe is comparable to Turkish people in the Kurdish movement.
Yeah.
They try to eradicate the power of Turkishness and show all the solidarity they have with the Kurdish struggle. So that is comparable, I think.
Yeah. And I would, in that sense, I would call upon Turkish people and Kurdish communities to learn more Kurdish.
Yeah.
To help the Kurdish languages develop further instead of so many Kurdish people having to resort to Turkish because they're not literate enough in their own language.
Yeah, true.
It's a political, emotional, and maybe even geographical migration, and surely a linguistic migration. Become bilingual, trilingual, that really helps.
Yeah, but learning languages
I'm
difficult for you.
And that means that, indeed, I speak several languages, and you get acculturated by the languages, the literature, the environment of these places also.
So let me ask you, Flair, how is your Kurdish?
Mm-hmm.
How is your Kurdish?
Oh, very bad. Very bad.
It's not easy to learn languages. Knowing languages is so nice, but learning them is always difficult. What gives you hope in your struggle? Because struggling can be hard and painful and everything, but there must be things that give you hope to keep going.
We do make progress. And experiencing it's a power struggle gives hope. There will always be another day. The winter won't take forever. We see that we make progress. We see that we're developing. Sometimes we're developing towards more legal recognition, for example. Both speaking from my point of view as from Kurdish points of view, there are legal progresses. There also be legal backlashes. But then the community gets better connected. There's more community. There's deeper community. We make alliances with other struggles. And that gives hope, because the more we are connected, the stronger we stand, and the easier we can take on the battle with the 0.1% or the 0.01% that is in power and that is making the world unlivable for everybody.
Yeah. So for you, if you can connect more again with the Kurdish community as a trans rights activist, that's also a hopeful thing. The more connections you make.
Very good. Yeah, and I see the recognition and the hope in the eyes of some Kurdish trans people that I encounter. Like, hey, there are people who are both trans, who are Dutch, white, trans, but also in favor of Kurdish autonomy, who understand this.
Yeah.
For many of them, it's still like almost separate issues for them. Like, yes, I'm Kurdish, but I'm also trans and I'm mostly struggling with that now. Yes, but at a certain moment, you will be kind of done struggling with that. And then you may find them to be both important and maybe both as important or both forming a basis in the rest of your struggle with the rest of your life.
I hope you're going to be successful, Freer, or as Kurt would say, Serkeftin.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Avershin Podcast, powered by Media News. Your host was Frederike Gering. The music you heard was composed and performed by Ula Jeshil. I would highly appreciate it if you shared this podcast on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or wherever you hang out online, so more people can find it. Thank you in advance, and until the next episode of Avershin Podcast.